Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening today. I'm always excited to spend time with you. I hope the feelings are mutual. We're going to have a great hour coming up. We're going to have a conversation with Richard Barr. He wrote a book called Those People, The True Character of the Homeless, and he has quite a compassionate ministry to the homeless. And there's a lot to learn, and there's lots of questions that I have for him based on encountering people who are homeless and getting behind how they end up being homeless, and what as Christians we do to be effective and compassionate, and maybe little things that we don't even think about that we might want to start doing, like effective, I don't know, on the drive home. Like right now, you're in your car heading home maybe, and you might pull up to that stop sign, and there might be that homeless person with the sign. And you sometimes wonder, can I believe the sign, or is that, I'm not sure. But anyway, we're going to learn a lot about that from Richard Barr in just a few minutes. And also, Michelle Lewis Freeman may be one of the fastest persons that's ever walked into this building. She was in the 2008 Olympics on the women's track team. This is what I call lightning in a woman, that she is fast. The 100-yard dash is her specialty. She's got a powerful story of what happens when you dedicate your life to Christ and you let you use the talents that he's given you to go make a difference. And she's got a ministry now called Track Girls with a Z. And she's out trying to be a role model and mentor to a lot of young girls through track. It's quite a story. That's all ahead in the hour. Thanks for listening. I'll take a very short break and be right back with Richard Barr.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. If you're new to Faith Radio, welcome. We're a not-for-profit, listener-supported radio station. That means we rely on listeners like you to help us keep relevant Bible preaching and family-focused teaching on the air and online. Your support of Faith Radio keeps us going and growing. If you would like to give a gift today, you can visit our website at myfaithradio.com and give simply and safely there. Thank you and welcome.
Stay informed on the latest events, compelling interviews, resource giveaways, and more by receiving the Faith Radio newsletter. It's an email we send out once a month that also includes inspiration from God's Word. Learn more about how God is using Faith Radio to bring clarity, healing, and hope to people all over the world. Sign up for the Faith Radio newsletter under subscriptions at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com.
Like most of us, we go home at night and we get to go through the front or back door, maybe even into a garage that's attached, and all of a sudden that feels kind of nice and secure. And you walk into a home and it's got heating, possibly air conditioning. You turn a lever and you get fresh water, and you hit another lever and dirty water goes away. That we've got some good stuff happening in our lives. We live like very wealthy people. And I think maybe we take it all a little bit for granted from time to time. But then there are the people that are without a home, and somehow they, even if you talk to them, they don't know quite how they got there. And some are been homeless for a while, and it's hard to get back on your feet. And my in-studio guest, Richard Barr, has written a book called Those People, The True Character of the Homeless. And I think it's something we all can learn a lot about, including the host right now, because I can hardly wait to learn what's in Richard's book. And Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, let's talk about just the idea of some of the stereotypes that go along with homelessness. Some of them must be true, right?
Yeah, indeed. People ask me that question frequently. It's like, aren't a lot of them addicts or alcoholics or lazy, mentally ill? Mm. And the answer is, some are. Indeed, they are, as are people in the rest of the general population. But, you know, homelessness is a lot more than an economic issue, is what I've learned. I mean, there's a myriad of issues. And I think when we've been We've been working with the homeless. It's like you have to unravel it one person at a time to really be able to help somebody.
Mm-hmm. The complexities of homelessness, it's not simple, is it?
No.
I think you look at people who say they're holding up a sign that says, I'm homeless. If we see that on the street corner, do we believe that? Or is that, you know, what do we do?
Yeah, that's probably one of the most popular questions that I get. So I wrote an appendix to the book about thoughts on dealing with panhandlers that maybe are a little bit unique.
Mm-hmm.
People will say, well, should I give them money? Or, hey, I thought I heard that there's a lady living in the suburbs that pulls down $100,000 a year while she's panhandling. And it's like, well, perhaps. I mean, I haven't met that person yet, but I guess technically that's possible. But specifically with panhandlers, you know, a summary of my thoughts would be that if you're asking the question, it seems as though God's pressed something into your heart to do something, and you just haven't figured out what it is yet.
Mm-hmm.
I carry gift cards. I carry socks, personal care items, a number of items that I will hand out to people. I've been in other towns where I've been ill-equipped. I haven't had anything with me, and I've actually stopped and gone back a couple blocks just to shake somebody's hand and introduce myself and tell them I'm sorry, I don't have anything with me. And I did that to a guy in Tampa a few years ago, and he was consoling me like, hey, man, no, it's cool. It's all right. I get it, man. This is great. Now, yeah. I'm like, no, you don't understand, man. When I'm home, I usually have something with me, and I don't, and I'm heartbroken, man. I feel terrible. He's like, man, this is the greatest thing today. He says, mm-hmm. This is awesome, mm-hmm. You know? So
what if it feels a little scary to stop and come into contact with someone who's homeless just because of, you know, maybe I'm a little afraid?
Yeah, I would never suggest that somebody puts themselves in harm's way. I mean, mm-hmm. I never do as well. I have taken people into my vehicle. Typically, they're people I already know.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't recommend that necessarily, but yeah, I wouldn't. I think it's a bit of a myth that homeless people are dangerous, but if you feel unsafe, I wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. When you get a chance in your ministry, and I want to talk about that, it's threshold2newlife.org. That's the threshold, the number 2newlife.org. And it's a ministry that you started in 2013 with your wife?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you started that to help people who are struggling with housing issues.
Yeah, and actually the work began before that, back about 10 years ago when I started serving breakfast with my friend Dave down at the Salvation Army. So we have another ministry called 2.4 Ministries that serves breakfast daily out of the Salvation Army Harbor Light facility. So we've got about 40-plus volunteers that show up at 4:30 in the morning, cook and prep for an hour, serve for an hour, and clean up for half an hour. So,
how often do you do that?
We do it every day.
That's crazy.
Yeah, for the last 10 years. Yeah,
that's
so
fantastic.
I'm down there myself one or two mornings a week.
Mm-hmm.
So Dave kind of wrangles all the supplies, and I try to manage the volunteers. So, so I'd been doing that for 4 or 5 years, and then my wife and I were leading a Bible study, and we did a study on the book Radical by David Platt, and it ruined our lives.
Yeah, in a good
really.
Way.
in a good way, of course. Yeah. In a good way, of course, yeah. And after that, my wife Carla said that we need to get organized what I'm doing. And wife seemed to have gifts.
Just like a woman.
Yeah,
we have to get organized, Richard.
You have to get organized. And, and so I've been learning what organized means for the last five years.
Your garage isn't even organized,
is
it?
Yeah, garage isn't organized either, yeah. So that meant, you know, a website, legal standing, 501c3, board of directors, and so forth. And it's interesting. So we were tasked with attempting to help people, but it was really, it was my wife's vision to do that. And it was really God's vision about specifically what that looked like. And that's where the housing assistance came. So somehow God connected a myriad of organizations within the Twin Cities, housing organizations, shelters. I was just sitting in the lobby here today, and we got an application from somebody from Hennepin County. So even the government uses us as a backstop where mm-hmm. they have cases where they, for whatever reason, can't step in or they need some sort of help.
Yeah. How does a person find themselves homeless?
Yeah, big question.
Yeah.
With lots of answers.
Yeah, I know it's complicated, but I mean, if I lost my house, I know one of my sisters would say, well, you can come live in our basement for a while.
Yep.
So I got back on my feet.
One of the teams I was serving with, we were driving home a few years ago and talking about what's the difference between us and the folks that we serve today. And we came down to just a few principal things. One, if you lost your job, you didn't have any money to back that up.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, you know, if my wife kicked me out, so I didn't have a home.
Right.
And maybe if I didn't have any local relatives that would mm-hmm. take me in. I mean, I probably have several buddies that would take me in, and their wives probably would grow intolerant to me. And
of course they would.
Ask me to leave.
Yeah, you'd be there 24 hours.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Get him out of the basement.
Yeah,
I can hear it already. Yeah. So talk about the kind of, when you encounter someone and you work with someone who's homeless, what are like the three or five things that you see consistently with people who are in a homeless state?
So when you work with them, like, what do we do?
No, or, I'm just trying to figure out what condition are they in? What's their state? When was the last time they had a shower? Did mm-hmm. they have problems with their feet? What are some of the things that rise to the surface when you encounter someone and work with someone who's homeless?
Right, yeah. It varies based on... So when you say homeless, I typically think of that as meaning they don't have a permanent residence, but they may actually stay indoors at one of the local shelters.
Okay.
So their physical condition is going to be much better than folks that are staying outside, like some of the campsites that I work, or if there's somebody staying under like a 394 overpass or mm-hmm. things like that. Their physical condition would be much worse. Spiritually and emotionally, psychologically, I think one of the things in common is that there's a sense of brokenness. I think that's common with all homeless people I've encountered, is that there's a sense of brokenness, and they're not fools. They're not stupid. They know the situation that they're in, and they know what the rest of us think about them. And so that's a burden that they carry with them throughout their day.
It's when you talk about the dire situation they're in, if they're homeless, and I would think that'd be pretty dire, especially here in the upper Midwest, where in Minnesota, I sometimes cringe walking, you know, from the car to the house going, it's really cold, but I'm walking into a warm house. What is it like to try to be stuck outside in the winter? Because there are people that live outside in the winter.
Yeah, there was a fellow, matter of fact, last year that I don't want to identify exactly where it was, but it was a quadrant of a freeway and an exit that was staying kind of along a utility pass, and he had a tarp set up and kind of a makeshift tent. He's a clever guy. He should have been an engineer. I mean, mm-hmm. some of the amazing things that he developed, he did to survive, were ridiculous. And so I would trek down there every other Saturday and deliver LP gas. I bought him a sunflower heater, you know, mm-hmm. that you kind of mount, like if you're ice fishing, you mount mm-hmm. to the top of a tank. So every other Saturday, I would go down and grab his two empty tanks, and I would bring back two other ones to replenish
wow.
that. But those weren't keeping him warm for 14 days, I can guarantee you that.
Yeah. Yeah. Richard Barr is my guest. We're talking about his book, Those People, The True Character of the Homeless. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we will continue this most interesting discussion in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have in studio Richard Barr. He is the author of Those People, The True Character of the Homeless. And as we're talking about homelessness, do people who are homeless, are they feeling defined by their homelessness, or are they just going, this is a rough season for me. Things are going to get better.
When I first started serving, it was during the last major recession that we had. And I was still kind of learning and experiencing what was going on. I would say, as I reflect on that, there were more people that were briefly homeless during that time mm-hmm. based on the economic conditions. They were generally the people that showed up at the shelters with real wide eyes. And I had people tell me, hey, I used to volunteer here or at places like this. And I would say now that the economy is so-called robust, many of the people that I see now it's a chronic situation.
Mm-hmm. And how, as Christians, are we best equipped to make the biggest impact? Obviously, we need to be loving people, but for the most part, I think homeless people are kind of, they're a little bit of a pariah for many, many people. It takes someone with some guts to say, I'll step into the mix.
Yeah, I liken them to, you know, the Bible speaks a number of times about people that had leprosy. Mm-hmm. And it's almost very analogous to that, where a leper was somebody that was separate from society, wasn't allowed in. Nobody would bring a leper inside their house. They would be deemed to be unclean. I see a lot of the homeless people like that. I think a number of the folks that I know are ashamed. I can't tell you the number of times I've had somebody that lives in a shelter tell me, you don't have any idea what it's like to go through your entire day with people not looking you in the eye.
I'm sure. And that's heartbreaking.
That's the lowest form of humanity is to make eye contact with somebody. And I can't imagine that. That's why at our breakfast that we serve, we greet people. We say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. We ask them what they like and how they like it and how much butter and how much sugar. And it may be the only time during the day that they get to choose how they want something to be.
And that makes such a huge difference, to feel that somebody cares about them. I mean, that's always step one, isn't it? Does someone care? Does anyone care?
Yeah, I think, you know, the currency of love is time.
Yeah.
And so I think spending time with people is really, it's really the way mm-hmm. that you demonstrate
that.
Do you find,
Richard, that homeless people are angry about, towards God, or are they resentful towards God? Or what's their attitude? Obviously, we want to give them, we want to provide food, clothing, help, whatever we can, but we also want to give them the gospel.
Yeah, well, so by nature, as we're having this conversation, we're using a wide brush. You know, we're making big generalizations, which is really what the book is designed to dispel. Really.
Okay.
There's lots and lots of exceptions. There's people that have great, robust faith that are in homeless situations. Actually, there's a whole chapter in the book with some examples of people that have ridiculous faith like way beyond what I have. That I admire so much.
You learn from them, huh?
Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Right,
yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And there are people just like in the rest of society that really struggle with their faith. They're angry at God. I live in a suburb. I got people on my block that are angry with God. So I don't know that that's distinctly different with homeless people.
Mm-hmm. But as we're trying to connect with them, how do we let them know that God loves them and cares about them if we don't first reach into our pocket and hand them some money?
Yeah, that's usually what I don't do, because otherwise the relationship becomes more of almost a codependent
mercenary
relationship.
Almost,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, you know, they're ringing the cash register expecting something from me. So I'll spend tonight in a couple of shelters this evening, and so usually what I do is I just spend time. I get to know people's names. I learn about them. I share about myself. It's amazing. Some of the evenings that I come home after working the lines outside the shelters, it was like a therapy session for me. I mean, I've had issues with my family and my
sure.
adult children, and I'm talking to them, and they're like, well, how's your son doing? I was like, oh, man, let me tell you the latest, you know. I mean, these people are my friends. I mean, they're human beings. I mean, they have emotions. They care. Not a lot different than anybody else that
mm-hmm.
I know.
All right, if we could go into a little coaching room now, and Richard, you're the coach. We all want to learn what are maybe the two or three smartest, wisest things we can do to be the face of Christ in a homeless environment or when we're around homeless people?
Yeah, well, big question.
I'll give you time to think about it. I could sing show tunes, but that won't go well.
I'm guessing everybody wants me to answer the question quickly.
I'm just saying I think it's a big question, and I personally want to know what to do because I sometimes am the guiltiest guy ever.
Yeah.
Because I'm on the phone and I pull up and there's someone with a sign that says, you know, homeless and desperate. And I don't know if that's just a tool to get some pocket change to go use drugs and alcohol. I don't know. I want to know how to do the right thing. I want to be able to make a wise, Christ-like response.
So I tell a story in the book about how when I owned a business and we had the leadership team at the end of the year, I would buy a bunch of trinkets and gifts and things for them that I picked out for them. And I would sit down with each one of them one by one and recap the year. They didn't report to me necessarily either. They were maybe lower level people. But I picked these gifts out and I'd give them the gifts and I'd force them to open the gifts in front of me, you know, and they would have to thank me. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, all of that may be a little awkward at times. But on the whole, they were all very, very gracious. But these were well-paid people. And there wasn't anything in the bag that they couldn't afford to buy themselves. But as I was exiting the business, so many people were so grateful for those times that I did that. And it was really about the thoughtfulness and about the care that I showed for them and the personal touch that I made that really made the difference. And so I think about what the homeless, I mean, what I do is, I invest time in the relationships, and I realize that not everybody's going to see a panhandler and be able to strike up a relationship with somebody. But even being thoughtful enough to have something with you to offer, and they, it may be something that they don't want, but you can carry, let's say you carry granola bars mm-hmm. or a gift card or some socks. You know, what that demonstrates to somebody is that, you know what, I knew I might encounter you today, and I made a plan in the event that I did so that I could actually do something that might matter to you.
Mm-hmm. So if I went to one of the big box stores, I won't call any of them out by name, but let's say I bought a box of 12 pairs of socks, and they were nice warm socks, and I live in Minnesota, and I had them in my back seat, and if I handed a pair out, it might be a good idea, might be well received.
Yeah, there's a particular big box store that you can buy 10 cotton crew socks for
nice.
$8. I've given out about 25,000 pairs of socks in the last 10 years, so I buy a lot of socks.
And that makes a big difference, doesn't it?
It does, indeed.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about thresholdtonewlife.org.
So we help with financial gaps that people have in their lives. They're usually small things. We do it with small grants to help people over their hurdle, or we might make referrals to other agencies that we believe can help them. Probably 80% of our caseload now comes via other organizations, or they fill out the application on behalf of somebody else. We keep doubling in size. I don't know if that's good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gone, last year we had 146 cases where we kept people from becoming homeless by helping them with small grants. This year we're on pace to help 300 people.
That's really impressive.
Well, one of the things I've noticed in the shelter system is that there's a big churn, and people will get some sort of a lift or assistance to get out of shelter and into some sort of permanent housing,
mm-hmm.
but they live with no margin. So any little thing goes wrong, like in the rest of our lives, right?
Yeah.
And they got no backup, and so now they're in trouble, and they're going to, I mean, it, literally people lose their homes over a few $100.
Wow. Okay, now with just about a minute left, Richard, can you give us a story of a homeless person you've encountered, and now they're out of homelessness and living a productive life, maybe even giving back to the homeless community?
Let me give you a different story, if you don't mind. I'll give you one of somebody still living in the homeless community, and he does so. It's a big, longer story. It's in the book, but he mm-hmm. does so that his Social Security check can go to his children's mother to be able to care for them because she hasn't been able to work, and he finds that he's unable to live there. So rather than going into housing, he's purposely living in a shelter so that she can get his check.
Mm, wow. A lot of stories. You're in the trenches for sure. I mean, I don't talk to a lot of people that are spending this much volunteer time doing what you're doing, and it's a huge inspiration. And I appreciate you coming into the studio, answering all my questions, and putting out this book. The book is called Those People, The True Character of the Homeless. The author is Richard Barr. And you can also check out the website if you want to head over to thresholdtonewlife.org. Threshold, the number 2, newlife.org. You can learn more about his amazing ministry. Richard, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I am already inspired because of my in-studio guest. Is going to be a great source of inspiration for me and for you, especially if you are a person that feels that you need to get motivated to move, because my guest is a mover. Michelle Lewis Freeman is founder and CEO of Track Girls, and she's got an illustrious athletic career that we're going to talk about. I'm going to let her unfold it. So, Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I look at your credentials, and you have so many things in your past that are so impressive. Let's start, if you wouldn't mind, with your experience as a track person in high school.
Oh my goodness.
I want to go back that far.
Well, that's a little ways. But in high school, that was actually my first time ever running track, period. My twin sister and I, we grew up playing sports and soccer and basketball. Those were our first sports, and we were always known as the Fast Twins. And so when we were in eighth grade, one of the high school coaches asked us at a mandatory track meet that we had to do for middle school fitness, you know, program, hey, you need to come try out for the track team when you get to high school. So we did, and then we found out we were really fast. So we actually quit basketball just to focus on track full time.
But you were really fast at basketball, too.
We were, but I was really fast enough that I knew that I can go to college for free.
Nice.
So we decided to go for it full time.
Yeah. Now, when you said your sister, is that your twin sister?
Yeah, twin sister.
Awesome.
She's 2 minutes older than me.
Okay, and what's her name?
Makisha.
Makisha.
Freeman. She married a Freeman as well.
Is that right?
Yes.
So your husband's brother, I
no,
assume?
No, like none.
Totally
random,
unrelated.
Another Freeman.
What are the odds? That's crazy.
Yes. So her name is Makisha Freeman.
Oh, okay. I don't even know where to take this interview from here. So let's just go on from there then. It sounds like you ran fast enough in high school to get a scholarship and you went to... Yeah.
South Carolina.
University of South Carolina.
Yes, Gamecocks.
And you got your bachelor's and master's degree in mass communication. So not only are you running fast, but you're paying attention in school.
Yes.
Way to go.
That was important.
I'm very impressed, just so you know.
Well, I knew I couldn't run forever.
Yeah.
I had to have a backup plan.
But in the meantime, you were running and you ran well in college. Let's talk about what happened in college.
Yeah, in college, we were able to be a part of the team that brought the first national championship in any sport to the university. Baseball actually won that next year.
Nice.
So,
you were number one.
We were number one.
How cool was that?
Very cool.
You must have been rock stars on campus.
We were. The track girls.
That's what I mean.
We were the track girls.
You brought a national championship.
Yeah.
First national championship ever.
Ever.
Yeah.
To the university. So that was just a good thing to be a part of. We were around a really good group of individuals from all over the country, and we just meshed really, really well.
All right, let's move on from there then, because you kept running and you kept getting faster.
That's the thing.
No humility. Just let's talk about it.
I know. Well, what happened is that I graduated undergrad in 02, and so the Olympics was the next Olympics was 04, but I had a bad hamstring injury, so I was like, all of my friends were still in college, so that's the reason why I really decided to stay and go to grad school. And then once I finished grad school, I wasn't even thinking about running anymore. I was actually engaged to a guy who went to South Carolina as well, but he was actually playing in the NFL for the New York Jets. So
I've heard of that team.
You may have heard. Actually, you know, lost to Minnesota. Was that yesterday?
That'd be yesterday. That'd be Sunday, yeah. We're not going to rub that in, though.
Right. So
now you've got engagement happening?
Got engaged, and so my major was advertising, and so, of course, New York is the advertising capital. So I went and did an internship at YNR, and, of course, to be with my fiancé. And when I moved to New York, we broke up 2 weeks later.
Oh, welcome to New York.
Welcome to New York, yeah. And this unpaid internship.
Oh.
So, you know, I thought I was about to be living a life. I actually was living a life for a little while. I mean, you know, he had a nice income. A
couple of weeks.
Yeah,
anyway.
A couple of weeks, you know. Well, we were together for 4 years.
Okay.
And he was playing. He was 2 years older than me, so he was playing a couple years before. Yeah, I went up to New York, and I had to make a decision in that moment. Was I going to stay in New York and figure out how I was going to survive, not making any money? And my mom, you know, she wanted me to come back. But if I did come back, then I wouldn't graduate to finish my graduate degree that semester. So I had to make a real big decision. And
what decision did you make?
I decided to stay. And that's when it got real as far as just, you know, the hustle. The hustle and understanding who you were and understanding who God was, really. I was isolated. I didn't have any friends or family. I'm from Maryland, so, you know, that's about a 4-hour drive, and that was the nearest point of contact that I had with somebody. But I moved into a hotel in Secaucus, New Jersey, and it was actually right across the street from the stadium, so I got to watch the Sunday game traffic every Sunday that I used to be in. And
wow.
Yeah, that was my life. In that moment.
Wow.
But you know what? I was a lot of prayer. That's when I was speaking to the at the women's conference. I was just saying that you think that you're alone, but that was the moment that God just really separated me so I could get to know him a little bit more and understand who he was so I can attack life in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Moving forward, I just didn't know that yet.
Yeah. So is your running career, it's not over yet, is it?
Oh, gosh, yes.
No, I'm not talking about now. I'm talking about back then.
Back then?
Yeah.
Well, at the time it was. I hadn't run in, you know, those 2 years at that point. I was in grad school. And this is 2004.
Okay.
So, I had graduated in 2002, so I hadn't run in 2 years. And I didn't think I was going to run anymore because I was about to be living a million-dollar lifestyle.
Okay. I just want to get to the 2007 Pan Am games.
Well, see, that was a whole nother story. I mean, it's a lot of time. So, okay, let me get there. So, that was 2004. I was living in that hotel and just decided to do the internship. I ended up staying. They ended up offering me a job. So I stayed in New York for 2 more years. No running whatsoever.
Okay.
And then my friends, you know, from college were making, they made the 04 team. They were still running professionally. And so the 08 games were coming up in 2 more years. So I'm like, hey, let me start to think about running again. So I went into my boss's office and I quit my job. And I moved to North Carolina to train full time.
Oh, this makes me laugh.
Because my boss was like, I told her, I said, hey, I'm about to quit my job to go train for the Olympics.
Yeah.
And she was like, yeah.
So she thought it was super cool.
Yeah, she thought I was super crazy.
As does every listener right now, too, just so you know.
She thought, I mean, imagine, I don't think she's ever had that conversation with someone saying they're going to quit to go train for the Olympics. So it was the first time for both of us.
Yeah.
And I really quit, and I really moved to North Carolina to train with a coach who had a history with Olympians and world champions. And I, 9 months later, was 07, and I really made the world championship team and was representing USA at the Pan Am Games at Worlds, and it was a whirlwind in 9 months. There you go.
You can't hang me out like that. That's crazy. Now, you were a silver medalist in the Pan Am Games, weren't you?
Yes. So I ended up, I was a 100-meter sprinter. That was my discipline from high school until when I retired as a pro. And the relay, so the 4x100-meter relays with the four girls, each running 100 meters. And that's what I ended up running at the Pan Ams as well, the 100 and the 4x1.
What did you run your 100 in?
Ooh. What's your 100-meter time?
Well, let's see. Let's go to the time that got you the silver medal at the Pan Am Games.
That was, I believe, I ran. It wasn't that fast for me. I ran 11:02, I think.
Okay.
But it was the time that I ran faster the year after that when I made the Olympic team.
Mm-hmm. What's it like when you're in the blocks getting ready to go, and you absolutely want to be out of the blocks as fast as possible? But you can't go too soon. What's it like?
Yeah.
What's that moment like?
Well, you know what? It's all about repetition. And so you train every day for that moment in the blocks. And you do the same routine that you do, that you practice every day. So your mind is, you're not even thinking. It's just, you just do the same thing that your body, you've been trained to do every day. And you feel ready. Like your body knows what it's about to do, and you feel like you're just in this. You feel like you're being held back, and you're just waiting for someone just to let you go so you can just burst out and just be able to do whatever you want to do.
Yeah. So, did you have a lot of rituals and tons of things that you would do every day in order to just be ready for this event?
You know, it was.
Did you tie your left shoe first? Always the left shoe first, and then the right shoe.
I know.
Little habits that you had.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, I mean, for me, it was just, you know, I always put my left foot first in the block, then my right foot, and I always look down a certain way and will find a certain focal point before I stop moving.
Okay, and then do you have a prayer in your head? Are you talking to God at that point?
Oh, gosh. It depends. So, okay, in 07.
I'm assuming the answer is yes.
Yes. Yeah, okay. So, like, in 07, I hadn't run. You know, I had taken those 4 years off, and I was facing Allyson Felix, Carmelita Jeter, all these, you know, the fastest woman in the world at mm-hmm. the time. And so I remember the night before I was praying. I was like, God, I cannot believe I'm here. You know, I just need you right now. And so he gave me Psalms 27. You know, Lord is my light, my salvation. Whom should I fear? The Lord is my strength. Whom should I be afraid? And I would just repeat that over and over again at the starting line, over and over again. And he was just letting me know, like, who, like if you have me, what else do you need? Yeah. Like, he's just around. Whom shall you be afraid of?
Yeah.
That was it for me.
Okay, now can we spring ahead to 2008?
Yeah, 2008. So 2007 was a good year, you know, after those 9 months of actually just, you know, making my mark back in the track and field world, I was like, okay, well, great. Like, God, this was great what you did for me in 07, but I really want to make the 08 Olympic team. So I was just keeping my relationship, my daily relationship with him strong, because it's a mental game, you know, in sports. That's, you really have to have your mind just in a place where you can't be defeated. And actually training for the 08 games, I got hurt and I couldn't run for 4 months. And so you can imagine mentally what's going on there. And so leading up to the Olympic trials, I was a little worried that I hadn't done enough. But again, it was just being strong in my faith and being strong in who I was as a person and knowing my capabilities. And so going into the trials, people knew me now, of course, and I ended up finishing, I think, seventh overall, if I'm not mistaken. But I ran 10 seconds in the 100, and not a lot of women can say that they've done that. My fastest time is 10.97 in the 100 meters, so that
was
a big
crazy.
Deal. Yep. You see, the thing is, you got to train. In practice, you have to train to cover every 10 meters, you got to cover in 1 second.
Right.
And so that's how you stay on track.
Oh, my goodness. That's so fast.
It's really fast.
That's really fast.
Yeah, I would die trying to do that today. But, yeah, so I ended up making the Olympic team for the relay, because top three make it for the open event. But I ended up making it for the relay, but it was still no guarantee that I would run, because they took 8 women as alternates. You know, you have to have alternates because only 4 get to run.
Yeah.
So I made it as an alternate, and I ended up actually running.
That's amazing. What a great story. Well, I don't want to brag to you, Michelle, but just the other day I ran a 4-minute mile in 17 minutes.
Oh.
I needed extra time to get it done. But
that's,
you know,
amazing.
Yeah, thank you. I figured you'd be impressed. Michelle Lewis Freeman is my guest. She is founder and CEO of Track Girls, just a track star and an inspiration. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to hear more of her story and lots more inspiration in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have in studio Michelle Lewis Freeman. I am delighted to find out she has a twin sister. And tell me her name again.
Makisha Freeman.
I know. Now, that this part sounds made up, just so you know. Makisha, who is her twin sister, married a man whose last name was Freeman.
And now we're the Freeman twins.
The Freeman girls.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Like we were the Lewis twins.
Exactly. Exactly. So, congratulations on making the Olympics, and where were they in 2008?
Beijing.
Okay.
Yes.
What was that like?
They put so much into executing an amazing experience. The opening ceremonies to this day is like unparalleled. When you walk into the village, you realize all you could say to yourself is like, this is really happening.
Mm-hmm.
In this moment, like, I made it. I'm here. It's just a cultural immersion and just a moment where everyone who's the best and the best at what they do are in one place.
That's crazy. Now, Michelle, tell me about what it's like to be a Christian living in that environment, because I've heard so many stories of the Olympic villages and what goes on there. I don't want to repeat it on a family-focused radio show, but, you know, I hear there's a lot of...
Yes. Yeah, I get it. Yeah,
okay.
No, but it's not easy. I mean, you try to just stay focused on what you came for, because at the end of the day, you get there and you get excited for being in that moment and where you are, but you still came there with a purpose. So I try to just stay focused on, you know, what God put me there to do.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you're going to get and see and be excited for everything that's going on. So it's not an easy thing, and you're not going to be the perfect, I don't want to say the perfect Christian, but I don't think anybody is. But you just stay focused on what the task is at hand and let that be your motivation.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Track Girls. What is the mission of Track Girls?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I started Track Girls 3 years ago with the mission to empower women and girls through the sport of track and field. giving them an opportunity to be exposed to world-class role models and know just what it takes to be successful in and out of the sport and how the sport can open doors from an education perspective, a health perspective, and a life skills, character building perspective. And so I do that by providing camps for girls and letting them interact with Olympians and world champions and giving them leadership skills, tips on technical things that if you wouldn't hear from anybody, but you get to throw a shot put with Michelle Carter, who's a gold medalist in the shot put. Cool. And, you know, how many times can you say you could do that? So I try to bring those opportunities that they don't, you know, once in a lifetime opportunities to the girls. And just show different women, you know, different health and wellness events that we could do to show how the sport can motivate you to just live a healthy lifestyle. So yeah. We do different track and field inspired fitness events as well.
Talk about what you perceive the health and well-being of young girls today. Are they moving enough?
Oh, well, I mean, statistics say that the youth in particular, I mean, a lot of, you know, everybody in the world, we should be moving more, period. My nephew can spend 8 hours literally behind the TV in his Xbox and has no motivation to get up.
Right.
And so when I grew up, we were out at all day until,
outside,
you know,
right?
The streetlights came on.
Absolutely.
You know,
you had, making it happen.
Yeah. And that's crazy because, I mean, we didn't even have cell phones. I'm like, my mom didn't even know where I was, you know. But
just be home by dinner.
Just be home by dinner
yeah.
and just out all day.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to just motivate people just to move, you know, just to get up and do something, be inspired, look around, you know, go smell the air. So hopefully we can show them by doing something fun like track and field inspired things and make it fun.
You started running races just even as a little girl.
Oh, street races.
Street races,
oh,
yeah.
I grew up street racing.
I would have hated to have raced you
as a kid.
So,
that's one of the events that we're going to do with track girls is street races. I mean, that is at the core of just being that girl who I was growing up. Just being competitive and on fire and just active and just having fun. The boys, they know you're fast and they're like, you can't beat me. And I'm like, well, we could race right now. You know, and you just going at it on the street, barefooted sometimes, just having fun.
So you get to be an inspiration and a role model to other girls. Who was a role model to you?
Oh, I mean, from a deeply personal standpoint, of course, my mom. I mean, she did so much to sacrifice to make sure my sister and I just was exposed. And so that's the biggest thing I learned from my mom. And so that's what I want to take on to the girls who I just expose, like show them the door. And however they want to do, you know, what they want to do with that, that's up to them. But I just want to expose. And that's what my mom did for me. From a sports standpoint, of course you have someone like a FloJo who, you know, had the beauty and the talent to back it up. I mean, and that's one of the premises of track girls is just the authenticity of being someone with talent and, you know, but they also, they take pride in their self-expression. They embrace who they are. They can wear big hair or blue lipstick or, you know, pink braids. You know, they just feel confident in who they are. And so that's what FloJo gave for me is just being able to embrace who you are and, you know, find that self-expression and embrace that.
Mm-hmm. And now you are married?
I am married.
Do you have children?
I have two, and I have two Batman villains.
Nice. I don't know what that means, but it...
They're named Bane and Harley.
Okay.
Bane with that mask thing on his face. I was pregnant doing, what was that, The Dark Knight Rises?
Uh-huh.
And my husband was like, that's a dope name. And I was like, that's great, but we're not naming my son that. Well, our son, technically.
Yeah.
But we did, and his name is Bane Freeman.
Uh-huh.
And then I was pregnant the second time when Suicide Squad came out.
Okay.
And someone pointed out that Harley Quinn was also a Batman villain. And since I was pregnant with the girl, it was fitting. So we have Harley. So now we have Bane and Harley.
That's fantastic.
5 and 2.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So as you get a chance to have these camps and talk to these young girls and be an inspiration and help them with their running and the workshops and everything you do, is there a chance you also have to share a personal side of your your faith journey and all that, or is...
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Tell me more about that.
So, I mean, I don't... When I speak to the girls, I also, it's hard for me to tell my story without being able to express the faith that it required, because it was such an instrumental part of it, that I can't separate the two. So I make sure that I just let them know my story, you know, and let them know how I was able to make it.
Speak from your heart, right?
Speak from my heart. And so, I mean, again, I just tell my point of view, and again, how they receive that, that's up to them. But I always share my point of view.
Yeah. Was your mother a woman of faith?
Yes. We grew up in the church.
Okay.
We grew up in the church. We were, you know, in the Black church, you know, the AME. You know, that was, you know, they are serious with you growing up in the church.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
On Sundays, Wednesdays, maybe Saturdays, who knows. But yeah, we grew up in the church for sure.
And do you sing as well?
I was in the choir. So, okay. Yes, technically I sing.
Okay.
Now, can I sing? That's another story.
Yeah. But you had a great experience growing up in the church?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the choir, I mean, to this day, I love worship. I love worship just from the whole choir experience. The youth ministry was a big deal, just growing up with like-minded peers, where you just, the church just brought you together in a way where it was just an organic interaction, and you didn't really realize that you were brought together because of, you know, the what your parents had was instilling in you, God and everything. But that was just organically just a part of the experience. It wasn't forced upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And you enjoyed being there, and then you enjoyed learning more about God just naturally.
You know, Michelle, what I really admire about you from the little I've gotten to know you is you have an identity which is rooted in Christ. It's not rooted in your track accomplishments. You enjoy your track accomplishments. You look back with fondness, but that's not what makes you tick.
No, for sure. I mean, because you evolve throughout life, and you have to have the one thing that's going to be this that's going to be there. You know, if your career changes, if your interest changes, if the people around you change, you know, that's going to happen in life, but you got to have that one thing that's going to be with you that keeps you grounded.
Yeah. I know being in professional sports the way you were, there's always going to be that season of potential disappointment, heartbreak, you blow out a hamstring, you go, I cannot believe I'm going to be 4 months without training.
Mm-hmm.
So you go into a period of maybe panic or discouragement. Did you have a verse or a place that you went to seeking refuge with God? Did you have a verse that you just would go back to all the time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, it started back when I was in New York when I first had the breakup. And I remember I was, this one day in particular, I was reading Isaiah 43. And, you know, God, he gave me that verse. He said, when I act, who can reverse it? And I was like, man, like, this is really over, you know, because we broke up before and we get back together, break up, we get back together. But God was telling me this time it was different. When I act, who can reverse it? And so I remember being so down that day. And then a friend of mine was like, oh, I have a scripture you need to read. It's Isaiah 43. And I was like, I already read Isaiah 43 today, and I'm not really feeling it. And she was like, no, you have to keep, no, it's Isaiah 43, 18, 19. And I was like, oh, you know what? I actually finished at about Isaiah 43, 13. So let me pick it back up and finish. And it was the same day that, you know, I had read that scripture earlier. And then when I got to Isaiah 43, 18, he said, forget the former things, for I'm doing a new thing. Do you not perceive it? You know, when it springs up, do you not perceive it? And I was like, oh, you know, when I act, who can reverse it? But forget the former things, because I'm doing a new thing. You know, it springs up. Do you not perceive it? And so that, when he gave me that scripture, it made me realize that God is always with me. Like, even when I don't feel it, or I don't think it, or I don't know it, like, he has his plan is greater, and he sees his eyes, you know, our eyes don't see, our ears don't hear, the plans that God has for us. And that, in that moment, I realized that I can always go back to that scripture and know that God always has a view that I won't ever see. And as long as I have faith in him, then...
I am a more joyful person today because I met you. Thank you.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, Michelle Lewis Freeman has been my guest. That's all the time we have. Have a great night, everyone. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.